I'm in Zechariah chapter 3 this morning, an odd place to be, I admit, but hopefully not so odd by the time we're done. Zechariah is a prophet during the season of God's people's return to Jerusalem after Babylonian captivity. Jerusalem is rubble, the temple is destroyed, God in his mercy has allowed them to come home, but they have very little to come home to except the place itself. Devastation abounds. And what God does in a series of visions with the prophet is he allows them to, through Zechariah, see what's going on behind the scenes of their present pathetic circumstances, to see the deeper spiritual realities of what is happening. It's a time of restoration from the disaster, from exile, because of sin. That's the real issue. It wasn't a failure of politics or military power. The issue underneath all the circumstances was sin. And so in chapter 3, Zechariah says that he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. And the Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, O Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is not this a brand plucked from the fire?" Stop right there. And so here's a scene in which Joshua, the high priest at that time, representing the people as a whole. And of course, the high priest has nowhere to minister because there is no temple. It's been destroyed. And so Satan stands before God legitimately accusing the high priest and the people he represents of being unworthy, what's implied in the context, being unworthy to be in the presence of God. And we see why in verse 3, because Joshua was standing before the angel clothed with filthy garments. He's filthy because of the sin of the people, the sin that led to exile. This is the true spiritual condition of God's people, of all people, including us, without Christ. This is the actual reality. And so, we keep reading that the Lord rebukes Satan. Why? Verse 2. Why? For no other reason than simply because God has chosen his people. God has chosen Jerusalem, the city of his people. And so we pick up in verse 4. Remove the filthy garments from him. That's what's declared. Remove Joshua's filthy garments. And to him he said, "Behold, I have taken your iniquity away from you, and I will clothe you with pure vestments." And I said, "Let them put a clean turban on his head." And so they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him with garments. So from head to toe, he is reclothed with pure garments fit for the presence of the Lord. And the angel of the Lord assured Joshua, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, if you will walk in my ways and keep my charge, then you shall rule my house and have charge of my courts, and I will give you the right of access among those who are standing here. I'll let you stay here. I've reclothed you, I've given you a fresh start, a restart, but you have to walk in my ways if you want to stay here. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, you and your friends who sit before you, for they are men who are a sign." And here comes the crucial part. Here comes the actual reality. "Behold, I bring my servant the branch." How can God actually just arbitrarily set aside his justice? Satan's accusation is legitimate. Joshua and the people he represents have no right, they're filthy, to be in God's presence. The accusation is legitimate. How can God do this? Can God just simply suspend his justice? Can God just make up the rules as he goes along? Can God change his nature? No, we find out how God can just seemingly arbitrarily maintain his choice of his people and reclothe the priest. "I will bring my servant the branch. For behold, on the stone that I have set before Joshua, on a single stone with seven eyes, I will engrave its inscription, declares the Lord of hosts." And here comes one of the most fascinating lines, cryptic at that time, but understandable to us now. "And I will remove the iniquity of this land in a single day." I will remove the iniquity of this land in a single day. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor to come under his vine and under his fig tree. And a time of fear in their frailty, and a time of doubt that things could really be fixed, God, through Zechariah, shows his people what's going on behind the scenes. Yes, you're in trouble. Yes, you are accused by Satan himself, and legitimately so. But I have chosen you to be my people, and my choice will not be thwarted. I will reclothe the priesthood. I will make it possible for you to stand before me if you will walk in my ways. How can I do this? My servant, the branch. We understand what that means from other prophets. The branch, the root from the house of David. The sole survivor, in a sense, meaningfully so, of the house of David. The one who can legitimately restore the Davidic kingship because of his own righteousness. He needs no atonement for his own sin. And he will be able to be God's agent through whom the sins of the world, the iniquity of this land, can be removed in a single day. A single day. We, of course, now know what they could not fully understand back then when God has Zechariah reveal this vision. How can sin and guilt be seemingly and arbitrarily set aside? Well, it won't be arbitrarily. Something will happen on a single day, a great day. We now know exactly what God was talking about when he rebuked Satan and he revealed this to Zechariah. We know it so well now that perhaps we take it for granted how stunning and stark the actuality is. You see, while this may seem like it was a Jewish problem in the scene in Zechariah, the truth of the matter is the people of Jerusalem are really just a cipher and a sign for the entire human condition itself. When Satan could stand before God and legitimately accuse all of humanity, including us, of being unfit to stand in his presence, to have life before him. We come to this table too often forgetting the starkness of the heavenly reality. We stood accused and guilty in the court of God's eternal justice, rooted in his own nature. Clothed in filthy garments, with no priest at that point to stand before us and intercede on our behalf. It's too easy to take for granted the stark reality of what Zechariah 3 speaks to. One of the things this passage leaves us with is a firm reminder of our condition before God without a great high priest. Of course, what's interesting in this passage is the name of the high priest in those days, Joshua, is the Jewish form of the name Jesus, a name which simply means salvation. Their human high priest at that point really had nothing he could do for them. He was guilty too. He was filthily clothed. It was God's grace that allowed him to be reclothed with clean garments because a greater Joshua, a greater high priest was coming who would not just be able to intercede for the people, for us, but be the sacrifice for the sins and atone for the guilt that had to be removed. That's why later on in the same prophet, chapter 12, and again, at that time, a mysterious revelation, a passage that makes more sense today. In fact, a passage that the gospel writers and later New Testament writers will appeal to in explaining the significance of what Jesus had done. Writes this in Zechariah 12 and verse 10. And I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy, so that when they look on me, and this is God speaking, this is a time of stunning mystery. How can God say this? How can God himself say this? When they look on me, on whom they have pierced. How could God be pierced? Well, you and I now know, because God would become human. And the person of Jesus, Joshua, he would do a high priestly work to remove the guilt of humanity in a day. When he went to the cross, and his feet and hands were nailed, and his side was pierced. And later, by revelation through the Spirit, inspired writers and preachers could say, this is that. When you look on Jesus, on him whom they have pierced, God himself pierced, those who will find salvation in him will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and weep bitterly over him as one weeps over a firstborn. And dropping down to chapter 13, on that day, there will be a fountain open for the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from sin and uncleanness. In a single day, God reveals in Zechariah, the iniquity of this land will be removed. On that day, there shall be a fountain open for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from sin and uncleanness. As we come to this table this morning, may we recognize in this moment how we are a people who experience the prosperity of the vine and the fig tree as we eat and drink the true food and drink of Jesus' body and blood. But may we not be so satiated with our peace and prosperity in this place that we forget the enormity of the hopelessness we were in, accused by Satan before God, filthily clothed, hopelessly represented, an accusation challenging the very justice of God itself to do something about all this sin and the people have committed it. And yet God stayed committed to us, his chosen people, rebuked Satan, affirmed his choice, and committed himself to a branch, a greater Joshua, a greater priest, a greater salvation, so that we can be in this place, this morning, at this table, rejoicing in our prosperity and in our peace. Every man under his vine and his fig tree. May the name of Joshua, Jesus, be praised forever. And may we truly eat and drink this supper, understanding the enormity of what happened in the heavenly places, a war that was brought down to the cross, and in a single day, our guilt was removed.